Welcome to Garden People with your host, Jill Sowards of Violet Air Studio. Join us each season as we speak with your favorite garden people, designers, florists, growers, naturalists, chefs, artists, and more about how gardens have shaped their lives and informed their work today, with seasonal tips, expert recommendations, and lots of plants. To learn more, go to our website at violetairstudio.com. You'll find episode information, our seasonal journal, class list, and seed offerings. Everything you need to start your own garden story. My guest is Lauren Elizabeth Palmer, founder and principal designer at the Wild Mother Creative Studio. Lauren and her sisters, Leah and Callie, are based in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, where they offer incredible floral design as well as in-person and online education. Their art is informed by their Afro-Indigenous heritage and reflects their reverence for the natural world, drawing together the threads of the past and present, beauty and activism to tell the stories of today. The care they take with their materials imbues their creations with passion and true joy. 2022 is the second year of the Send Flowers 2 campaign, through which the Wild Mother creates floral art installments to honor, draw attention to, and heal intergenerational community trauma. This year, the campaign highlights missing and murdered Indigenous women, or MMIW, and involves an installation at the First Americans Museum in Oklahoma City from May 7th to May 9th. Please follow the links in the show notes or at thewildmother.com to learn more and join me in contributing to this important cause. Lauren, thank you so much for being here. Welcome to Garden People.
Yeah. Halito, so chafayat Lauren Palmer. Chatasia, Oklahoma, Amintalili. Utali, the Wild Mother Creative Studio, Atok Salili. Hello, my name is Lauren Palmer. I am the principal designer of the Wild Mother Creative Studio in Oklahoma City on Kickapoo, Osage, Wichita, and Comanche lands, which should be returned back to their first keepers. Yakoke, for having me on your podcast today.
So I'd like to begin by asking you just to describe yourself and your work.
Yeah, so the Wild Mother is a creative studio where we do floral design and actually a lot of different stuff, but floral design is our central medium. It's myself and my two sisters, Leah and Callie. Yeah, so do floral design, then also we have education offerings. So in both floral design and workshops around that subject, and then also we teach, we don't like using the acronym DEI, but we teach how to create affirming, equitable, and just brands within the creative industry. So that's something that we are excited about. So yeah, that's a bit of what we offer.
And what was the journey to creating the Wild Mother?
Well, so I think it takes us back to college. Leah and I attended university together. And while we were there, I always had like flowers and stuff in my apartment. And then when I graduated, I moved out into another a bigger house and had flowers there. So when a lot of our friends started getting married, there were a couple friends that asked, would you do flowers for our weddings? And we loved the thought of it and jumped in and really, really enjoyed the process of it all. So then when we started getting phone calls from people that we didn't know, we decided we should probably investigate this as a business opportunity. So we did, and the rest is history, I guess. Yeah. So that's where we started. There are a lot of influences around plant life and just like natural materials in our family. So it seemed like a really good fit.
Yeah. And because you have these three partners or a partnership of sisters, one thing that I really admire about the creative studio is that it just seems to move with such intention in all areas, both sort of the, what one would say, maybe the artistic side, and then also the kind of melding of art and activism. And so I was wondering how you three coordinate or collaborate to develop those ideas, how you almost divide the work, if that is how you do it.
Yeah, it totally is. So a lot of times ideas come to the table. We like to say that we meet in the middle and we dream up thoughts and ideas. And then it's very much about dividing tasks. So I am our principal designer. So a lot of what you see floral wise is the bulk of it is my responsibility. Of course, like we all work within all aspects of the company, but yeah, I do a lot of our ordering and conceptualizing and stuff like that. And then for the education arm, Leah is our principal storyteller and lead education, fearless leader. Leah has a background in education. So she taught higher ed for a few years and then pivoted a bit in her career, obviously. So she's a natural in the classroom, and I'm so lucky. I've learned so much from Leah over the years, but she's very wise and such an asset to our team. And then Callie she's gifted in operations. So every bit of what is organized in the event process, that's Callie. She keeps us very well organized and staying to task. And she's such a gift on our team. We work really well together. And I think that was something that was instilled in us. And we actually have two other brothers. So in the five of us, we work really well together because our parents made sure that was something that was at the bedrock of our family culture. I think a lot of times people ask, what is it like working with your sisters? And honestly, we have to remind ourselves that our sisterhood is sacred and that comes first. So managing sisterhood ends up lending itself really well into managing business dynamics.
That's wonderful. And one of the themes that I've noticed you all mention in your work is art as medicine. So I was wondering what that means to you and then how you incorporate that into the public art of the Wild Mother.
Yeah. So there have been seasons of my life and even people that I love and or even just am acquainted with where art has been an integral communicator of care. And it's if we look back on the history of floral, cut flowers, they're always used as tokens of expression. And that was something that we were really attracted to early on. This is such a wonderful vehicle to be able to share how you're feeling. But then under the larger umbrella of the Art Academy, art is such a wonderful tool to be able to administer medicine. It has this quality about it that's so, I don't know, this might sound weird, kind of otherworldly. Mm-hmm. It connects us to creator. And that's something that is really special to us. So when we talk about art as medicine, we mean taking what we have created and honestly, every step in the process of creating it and then sending it out into the world or sending it to a person or a family and letting it be what it is, letting it be that means of communicating, I care, or I'm grieving with you, or I love you, I see you, I honor you. So we've seen how that looks in our company. And last spring, we were able to send art as medicine to a community that had long been overlooked. And the power of those gestures was just so visceral. And I remember feeling kind of out of body. And I'm sure the other artists that are listening now can relate. When you are giving and thinking outside of yourself, I don't know. It's almost euphoric, but that's what it means to us.
Well, and I think you might be referring to the Send Flowers To campaign. Is that what you're thinking of?
That's right.
Yeah. Could you tell a little bit about the campaign and the project?
Sure. Yeah. Last year, we launched this concept called Send Flowers To. It's where we acknowledge painful histories and the communities that hold these histories. And a lot of the times, the trauma is still there. And the inaugural year for Send Flowers To was last year. We highlighted Greenwood, which is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We're in Oklahoma City, so it's, a stone's throw away. But it's interesting. The history that we were highlighting was around the Greenwood Massacre of 1921. And I had never been acquainted with the story until I was, I think, in my late 20s. And I'm an eighth generation Oklahoman. And I was educated in Oklahoma City public schools. I went to a private university in Shawnee, Oklahoma. So I'm saying all this to say Oklahoma is in me through and through. And I was not familiar with the story. Mm-hmm. I'm also being Afro-Indigenous. I was sitting with that early on in the project, sitting with it, like, how did I not know about this? So we are hoping to unearth stories that are largely unknown in the mainstream and shine light on them so that we can, honestly, it's an act of like requiem. There were hundreds of people that were murdered at Greenwood, and the story, I encourage listeners to dig into the story if they haven't yet, but mm-hmm. the story is just so gripping and tragic. But the work that organizers in Tulsa have been doing and artists much like me and my sisters are doing to shed light, I think that there's healing, there's collective healing that's happening, and that is the central goal. Yeah. So this year we're taking on Send Flowers to Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women. It's another issue, another crisis in Oklahoma. And Oklahoma history is partially built on this crisis, but we are just so passionate as Indigenous women. We're passionate about this. So essentially, the crisis is centered around women who are targeted and or missing and or murdered. Honestly, like, the issue is one around policy and lack of community care, and it's issues around land sovereignty, tribal sovereignty. So yeah, we're very passionate about this one. We're going to be installing site-specific floral work on May 7th. It can be viewed May 7th through the 9th at First Americans Museum in Oklahoma. And we're going to be sort of folding into other MMIW Awareness Day programming. And yeah, there's a lot there, but I encourage listeners mm-hmm. to follow along on this journey of working with organizers and our relatives in Indian country. Yeah, it so far has been so, so impactful. And it's also close to home. The girls and I have an aunt that we never met. She was murdered mm-hmm. in California in the 90s. And another Indigenous woman, a part of the statistics, but she was a very real person and a part of my family. So anyway, it touches a lot of different threads. We're excited and also reverent towards this work.
And I know you are classically trained. Mm-hmm. I think these projects really bring home to me this idea of being open to artistic communication, almost like the classical mm-hmm. idea of the muses.
Yeah.
And how it impacts different spheres of your life. So I was wondering if you could share a little bit about how you stay open to that, how you kind of listen to that and are able to incorporate it.
Yeah. So I find myself as an artist wanting to be very like present and honoring of the things around me. And a lot of times that looks like living in reciprocity with all the things that I'm in contact with. So I mentioned my sisterhood earlier. Mm-hmm. I mentioned that I am Afro-Indigenous. So that means that I have connection to the Black and Chata and Mexican communities. I'm living in reciprocity with my relatives there. And then also just like living in reciprocity with other created things. I think that listening and being observant and then also deciding to agree with the impulse to create is really, that was something I had to learn as a younger mm-hmm. artist. I didn't really understand the power of following inspiration when it strikes. Mm-hmm. But I think for me, that is where I am right now. I know that I'll evolve, and I'm always holding this hope of being a good ancestor one day, an honored ancestor one day. And so, yeah, I know that as I am growing into an elder and into an ancestor, my work and maybe my processes and art will evolve too. I'm sure they will. But mm-hmm. yeah, that's where I am now.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Well, it makes me think a little bit about, as you became a floral artist, any influences that existed in your childhood that may have led you to that creation, gardens in your history, in your life.
Yeah. Yeah. So there are lots of nods to land care and land keeping in my family. So one of the most obvious for me, and I feel really nostalgic about it, is time spent in my childhood with my cousins. There were 13 of us on our Meemaw and Pawpaw's land. There was like a small pasture in the back, and the springtime was the most magical because there were like tons of wildflowers. So coneflower would pop up just naturally after a rain, or there were like lots of milkweeds and stuff like that. But our pawpaw, while we were running around playing and stuff, he was tending this pretty large scale garden that he had on the north side of the property. And he grew a little bit of everything. But I remember okra and collard greens and these giant tomatoes and grapes and peaches and pears. And yeah, he's actually, or was, a master gardener. So he had knowledge that if I could go back, honestly, Jill, I would like sit under him every day and just like listen intently and just like write notes. And he was really quiet and pretty stoic. He was a doctor and a soldier, but this love of land was something that really impressed me, made an impression on me as a young girl. And he passed when I was 22. So I had brief time with Papa, but he made a significant impression on me. So Meemaw and Pawpaw would harvest from the garden, and then during the summers would can, and then we would eat from the cans, like from their pantry during the winters. So that was on my mother's side of the family. And then on my dad's side, my great-grandmother, Gladys, and we called her Gigi Mama, she had this beautiful house. The front porch was like a deep-set porch, and she had like Southern gentlewoman of her, like all of the like the wicker seating, and she would bring out pitchers of lemonade, and that was very much her vibe. But she had the most prolific garden, like in the front, and there were tons of flowers, and she attracted lots of like pollinators and hummingbirds. And yeah, so I remember being, it felt like the scene in that like 1990s version of Secret Garden when when Mary would like, she opened the gate and like the music swelled, like that's what it felt like on her porch. And I'm really proud of my elders and the way that they encouraged this like care and love of the land. Even Papa, like letting the land rest every 7 years or every seventh year, he and like the other elders were just very thoughtful that way. And it's a beautiful testament to, or of redemption, I think, because the traumas that our Black and Indigenous and Mexican ancestors experienced on North American land through like chattel slavery and relocation, removal, Indian removal. And it's a powerful testament to like, or of this reciprocal love between my people and the First Mother. So I love musing on that. I could muse on that all day, but yeah.
That's wonderful. I don't know if it is that story that I see in your work, but I always think of your arrangements as being really having this sort of warmth in them. And so I didn't know if that was something that you can share about how you create those arrangements, that anything that you sort of think of as you're doing it.
Yeah. So we were taught to honor all things. So that includes the Sims that we use at our studio. And a lot of times, like when I first began, I would try to force flowers in vessels and make them look a certain way, look how I wanted them to look. And these natural products, these materials were coming to us from someplace, from a bush or a field or, you know, hoop house or whatever. And I remember this like kind of like revelation, like, I should just let these materials like be what they are. They get to tell me how they're used in these arrangements. So, and honestly, like that takes a little bit longer. Every time I try to rush and, you know, just create something really quickly, there's always something about it that I'm like, I really don't like that. But when I allow maybe like a natural bend in a sweet pea, or the way that we will get garden roses from farms like in your neck of the woods, and we'll have them shipped here, and sometimes they're low hanging or they're bending a certain type of way, and I'm just aware that like it's due to the wind or the sun or the rain, like, and I honor that too, you know, I honor the way that they were touched by the other elements. So, and this is not just flowers. I think when we use, the girls and I use sweetgrass in prayer, or when we use coneflower or olive leaf or whatever, like in for medicinal purposes, there's always this gratitude, like, oh, thank you. You know, I think that that's really important in floral design for us. We want to be sure that we're like honoring what these materials are and acknowledging that like they're from our first mother and they're also from Creator. So we get to, I don't know, they're all gifts. We're all gifts to each other. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's something that I found. And as I'm designing, it's a good thing to hold on to at the forefront, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You give me chills. And so do you have a private gardening space today of your own?
That's a good question. It's kind of a yes or no answer, or yes and no, I should say. So Leah and I, we sit on a board in Oklahoma City. So we're active members of the Midtown Community Development Foundation in Oklahoma City. And the first project was or is an urban garden. So the way that that looks is there is a farmer that tends land that is smack dab right in the middle of Midtown. So there are lots of, and I think this is something that's becoming more popular. As a matter of fact, I was talking to a friend, another Indigenous friend of mine just last weekend, and we were discussing like how urban spaces will probably become more and more used for like food production.
Interesting, yeah.
I think we're going to go back a little bit, maybe like the reemergence of the Victory Garden. But it's sort of like that. It's in an urban area. It's just a plot of land that is in, so in, as we were talking through like what this could look like, there were lots of dreams of the space being used to like feed the underfed and to nourish the overfed. So it's interesting, this place or where it's situated, there are a lot of unhoused people, and then there are million-dollar homes like right in the same area. And it's super indicative of like urban life. But it's interesting the responsibility that this project holds to honor both feeding the underfed and or nourishing the underfed and feeding the overfed. I can't remember like the exact mission verbatim, but as we were talking through, there were all these beautiful ideas of what this could look like. And I think it's important to mention that this plot of land is situated on Kiowa, Osage, Wichita, and Comanche land. And the garden, well, that's one thing. And then the other thing is Leah and I, my sister who sits on the board alongside of me, we are the only people of color on the board and in the project at large. So as we were sort of dreaming and planning, there was this, we express that it's imperative that we're sure that we are honoring land sovereignty and that this garden is indigenized and not, I think that it would be a shame, or at that point I thought it would be a shame to build a garden and then have to decolonize the foundation. It felt just a lot easier to build it, especially considering that it's on native lands anyway. So yeah, it's really interesting how the dream sort of played out in practice. And honestly, it's a bit of a, I hold a bit of tension there, or it feels like tension. I want to lend my voice, being both Black and Indigenous, but also just wanting to be a good land keeper, but then also not knowing if I am strong enough to be able to like see about the building of this garden in an equitable and just way. Mm-hmm. And when I say just, I mean justice, like the act of setting things right. So if we're building a new garden on native land, this setting things right for me would be to have native land keepers or the original land keepers all throughout the project. And I'm working on it. It's interesting. I think that just being where I'm from and the beliefs I hold, I think that I'll always hold that tension, like wherever I go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting. So thanks for like listening to all that. It is very much a like yes and no answer. It's satisfying and exciting to eat the food directly from the garden. It's really encouraging and such a beautiful like picture of the work that we've put into it. But yeah, we'll have to talk again and I'll give you updates.
yeah, please. No, it's navigating that, you know, involvement. It's there is inherent tension, as you said. And it reminds me a little bit about one of your course offerings, your online course offerings, Lay of the Land, because I think that speaks to how to educate creative individuals, but anyone sort of starting a project. So I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about that too.
Sure. Yeah. So Lay of the Land is a course offering from the Wild Mother. And if I were to classify it, it would be situated in a DEI category. So essentially the girls and I saw a need in the creative industry for creative brands, business owners, and even just people who are thinking of the prospect of building a creative brand, for them to have access to tools that folks in the corporate sphere might have more readily available to them. So the goal in writing the curriculum and laying out all of the online components, it was birthed out of a bunch of questions that were asked of us, around how to build equitable and affirming and just brands. How do we actually do that? We believe that it is a holistic process and practice. And I also think for brands that are pre-existing, it might mean doing the work alongside of a consultant or an offering like ours to seek out the pain points and maybe seek out the blind spots and prune them away to make way for new growth. And so that is the goal of Lay of the Land. Practically speaking, it's a curriculum that is laid out in 6 movements. So we talk through the foundations of building a brand like what I just described. So we talk through origins and how to clearly communicate an origin story. One that is not timid or one that doesn't induce shame, but one that is like one that the person that's telling their origin story can be proud of. And then we move on into how to build that brand. And then we give a lot of key terms, or we define a lot of key terms that honestly pop up in conversations around justice, especially as these conversations move closer and closer and closer to the center of mainstream conversation. So honestly, I'm so proud of this work. I think that it's a really beautiful offering. And the fact that it's made for creatives, we knew that it had to be like aesthetically pleasing. So we spent a lot of time working through what it would look like, and we're able to infuse a lot of ourselves in it. So there are photos. I share my origin story as an example in this. It's a downloadable PDF, and I think it's nearly 90 pages of content. And then we built a fictitious brand that we use as a case study for people to learn from. So it's a hefty offering. If it were me, I think I would sit with it for a few months. I would work through it slowly, but I could see also going through it in a weekend and revisiting it over time.
Yeah, definitely something to build on.
Yeah, there's a lot of information in it. And also, we all evolve and our brains evolve too. So I think that it would be a really good investment for the long haul.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think I mentioned to you that I am looking forward to taking the course. I think it just, as you described, the lens that it has, and also it just seems to come so naturally from your desire to educate in this space, as opposed to other courses. I really felt a connection to kind of your own creative spirit. So I'm very excited.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you'll have to give me your feedback.
Yeah, please. I'd be happy to. Would you mind also talking about some of the other course offerings that you have?
Sure. Yeah. So we also have online workshops available on our website. So they go through making a table arrangement. There are a few varieties of bouquets that I teach, and table styling. It's very much for the visual learner. We also have downloadable PDFs for folks to be able to follow along. And yeah, so all of those have been filmed and they're available on our website. So if you go to thewildmother.com, I think it's /workshops. Yeah, that's where you can find all of that information along with Lay of the Land. It's all on that landing page.
Okay, wonderful. And well, just for anyone listening, those will all be in the show notes, so you can find them there.
Awesome.
And then you also do one-on-one in-person trainings as well?
Yeah, so that's an offering. Okay. We'll do a consultation. And honestly, this is much like our wedding offerings, our event offerings. We like to get a good idea of like the scope of work. I don't think that it's ever our desire to sort of like shove someone's needs into a box that we have predetermined. Mm-hmm. So for people who think that they might need one-on-one consultation, yeah, we have this process of asking, well, what do you think that you need and how can we best help you? How can we serve you? And then we'll come up with like a plan, almost like a syllabus, but yeah, a plan for moving forward if you choose to work with us.
That's wonderful. We're moving into spring. So you're, mm-hmm. I guess we'll be working with different materials.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could share a little bit about what that means, kind of both in your arrangements and then also kind of in your world, what you see and expect in spring.
Yeah, totally. So we love spring so much. So materials like dogwood and cherry blossom and sweet pea and fritillaria. And I know this is not like just a spring offering, but we love tweedia a lot at our studio. Mm-hmm. And then there's this foliage called California lilac. I'm sure you're super familiar with it, but it makes this, I don't know, just like the color is so stunning to me and it translates so beautifully in like any light. So as a matter of fact, we did a little shoot. So it was just the two of us. Callie was out of town, I think. So Leah and I did the shoot and we waited until dusk. We have like these three really big windows in our studio that are west facing. So we waited until dusk to shoot and the color of the California lilac was just incredible. Like I don't know, it translated really well, but yeah, we're really excited about that. And then just like in our world, I think right now I'm really excited for, like I was mentioning earlier, we use sweetgrass a lot in prayer. And I think summer is like what I tend to be most excited about because that's when like okra and watermelon and collard greens and to eat from the Three Sisters garden. So mm-hmm. the squash and the beans and the corn and yeah, just super excited about that. So we like to use plants not only in our studio work but like just daily living and cooking. And yeah, honestly, more recently it's been this beautiful act in reconnection for us just all around. So learning how to cook West African and North African mm-hmm. and South African foods and indigenous foods that our Chata elders cook, and then also like Mexican foods. And it's such a beautiful experience, and also just like reconnection through natural materials is so joyful. It reinvigorates the soul in a way that like nothing else could. And I don't know. I'm just really enjoying it. But yeah, using plants as medicine and yeah, has been really special. So this spring and summer, I'm looking forward to digging in again and having fun with it.
Oh, wonderful. You've mentioned kind of the energy of certain flowers, which this conversation is reminding me of. I'm thinking particularly about your description of sort of the colors used in your most recent Thanksgiving arrangement, so the 2021 Thanksgiving. And so I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you use that in your work.
Totally. Yeah. So we wanted to be very intentional last fall. The arrangements that you're mentioning, the harvest arrangements were very, we knew we had an opportunity to be very poetic about it. So Thanksgiving, as I get older, is more and more like painful for me. And just considering what it means for me and my elders and my ancestors. But we love celebrating a bountiful harvest. So fall feels like all fall feels like that. We knew, though, that our next Sunflowers 2 installation and projects surrounding the installation would be centered around MMIW, and the color that the movement props up and has, starting in Canada, that's where the movement started, and it, you know, made its way south into the United States. But all of Turtle Island uses red as the color to symbolize the movement. So we knew that Thanksgiving had the story, or, you know, we all know the story, whether it's the romanticized story or the story that the Wampanoag tell, that it's the story around like Western settler contact on Turtle Island. And we, historians and knowledge bearers and keepers in indigenous communities, any one of them will tell you that there's a direct link between Western settler contact and this MMIW crisis. So in announcing our intention to send flowers to MMIW this spring of 2022, we wanted to honor the women, beginning with Matoaka, who I think a lot of people commonly know her as Pocahontas. She is the first recorded, or what we know now as the first recorded missing and murdered Indigenous woman. And all the way through like modern time. As a matter of fact, on the day that we announced our intention and gave more clarity around why we chose red, and red is the color of the flowers for those arrangements, there was yet another missing poster that circulated across social media about a young girl. Her name is Tiana Givens. She was 12 years old, Afro-Indigenous girl from Oklahoma City. And honestly, Jill, like those posters, a new one is published like every day. And in Oklahoma, like so many of our sisters are being targeted and stolen, and just, and a lot of times we don't get them back, and we don't know where they went or where they ended up. So just last weekend, there was another girl who is about 100 miles away from me. So anyway, we don't want to do or design flowers just for, I don't know, just for the heck of it. I think there, as artists, there is a very profound, pronounced, and significant like opportunity that we have to storytell and to educate and to pay homage or requiem, or I don't know, like it's this massive container and it's such a gift. But anyway, so we used that opportunity for that holiday to share our intention for spring 2022. And there have been other moments, like for Sunflowers to Greenwood, we wanted to honor the fact that white lilies are a flower in the Black community that are used pretty prolifically when we're honoring the life of someone who has passed. Or even at Easter, there's this beautiful song called Ride On King Jesus. And it's like this old, like Negro spiritual. And it mentions like in the great get up morning, fare thee well. And a lot of times these sounds and these images that are conjured are like tied to white lilies. So we use white lilies a lot in those installations. And yeah, the opportunity to be thoughtful about like the materials that we use. I know that there's so many artists that do this well and I'm just so inspired by it. But I think the first artist that I remember being like, oh, wait, that's amazing. Like, that was so effective. Degas does that a lot in his paintings. Mm-hmm. He uses these beautiful, like, obviously, like, impressionist paintings, but then he has these dark streaks of black that he puts in the work. And it's this, you know, as you learn more about his life, like, it makes so much sense why he would use, like, such a harsh stroke, like, in something that's, like, kind of dreamlike. So anyway, yeah, it's... We play with color and texture and even like flower types, just in an effort to be like thoughtful and to be honoring and yeah, to tell a story.
Yeah, yeah. And do you have any other people books that you take influence from?
Yeah, so there are a handful of people that just like if I engage their work or if I ever meet them,
yeah,
it just makes me like super emotional. I think one of them is Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's an author, Indigenous woman. She's also a botanist, and she has been really remarkable to me. She kind of serves as an elder in my life. I mean, even though I don't know her, her wisdom is like just so remarkable. Another that is really important to our team right now, she just became an ancestor, is Bell Hooks, another Afro-Indigenous creative that is so clear about her musings on love. And we follow Leah's lead a lot in like Leah studied Black and Native literature in grad school, has a lot of research under her belt, and I'm grateful for her like knowledge that she kind of like passes it on to me and Callie, knowledge that she learned from other, you know, like scholars around how to interpret or how to understand bell hooks' writings. But then another for me is like Yo-Yo Ma. Like, I don't know why, but like, he always makes me cry. And it's not like, not just his playing. I think he's such a wonderful performer. But one time in middle school, he came to Oklahoma City and he had a show or a concert, yeah, at our Civic Center in Oklahoma City. And beforehand, a lot of artists will do this. They'll have like a master class before, like the afternoon before. And so we were invited, Leah and I went to an art school in Oklahoma City. So a lot of the strings musicians were invited to go to this master class, and we did. And it was, I don't know, like the feeling of being in the room with a great was like overwhelming. But then after there was like a meet and greet, and we were there with our grandmother, she was like, you know, our adult who was present. But anyway, <Yeah. laughs> there was a meet and greet, and there was this woman, I don't know why she chose this, but we were the last in line. And right when we got to like where we were able to go greet him, she said that meet and greet was over, and she was kind of rude about it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, my grandmother tried to, you know, get her to like, is there any way, like, he's right there. He was like 20 feet away from us. And
yeah.
Anyway, I still like get chills thinking about this, but he told the woman like, oh no, no, no. Like, I need to meet these girls. And he like gestured with his bow for us to come over to where he was. And
yeah,
he let us touch his instrument. And of course now, no, as an adult, like I know now, like that was his practice instrument. Like, but still like to be like next to him. And he was so gentle and so kind. And I think he was able to sort of like empathetically feel what was happening in that moment. The woman made a decision to send us away when she just had that power in that moment. But he still, I don't know, still is such an impact in my life. And a couple years ago, like we shared some work online and he saw it and shared it with his audience. And I don't know, he just continues to be so wonderful and lovely, but he's another for me, like an all-time favorite.
Yeah. Oh, that's so beautiful. Yeah. I've, you know, heard a few interviews with him, and he always seems like he really has this wonderful, wonderful soul, and that really comes through. That's such a sweet, sweet story, and how wonderful to have this continuing relationship with him. That's great.
Yeah. He's amazing.
And in your floral work, do you have any favorite flowers or plants that you always look forward to kind of returning and getting to use?
Yeah, so my favorite flower is a champagne rose. It's a sweetheart and sweetheart variety. I just love how it ages. It starts, you know, like really hardy, and then like as it sort of starts to like fall away, it's just so beautiful. So I know that Callie's favorite flower is a hellebore. Mm-hmm. We call them Lenten roses down here. And Leah's favorite is a Tweedia. I also really like limelight hydrangeas. They're just so stunning. Peachy hydrangeas are just super beautiful. But anyway, that feels very much like so southern. And like, I know that they can grow in other places, but it makes me think of our meemaw and pawpaw and like all of our roots in the South, in Texas and Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Louisiana. Yeah, a lot of our elders come from those places. And so blood memory is strong. And I feel like those places are home too. So they feel nostalgic to me. Those hydrangeas do. But yeah.
That's wonderful. And then the question that I always ask our guests, was wondering if based on these experiences, how you think we might be able to bring more people into the garden, either gardens or the art of floristry, what worked for you and any areas you think that are, I guess, ripe for change or are.
Yeah. So that is such a beautiful question. I think that when you asked that question just now, I'm garden is kind of like a metaphor for me. Like it's a picture of something like bigger or greater. And I know that like tangibly speaking, like the garden is a very real place, a very real thing, and it gives so much, but Jill, if that was like a university class, like I would enroll in it. Like if that one question was like a class, I'd be like, yes, I'm in. So I believe that Creator meant for our joy in the garden, and that there's so many gifts there, so many surprises in the garden. In our Chata origin story, we come from Ninawaya. It's a mound. It's an actual place in Mississippi. That's our place of origin. And actually the mound in the story, the mound is a womb, and it held two brothers, Choctaw and Chickasaw, in the womb. And the Choctaw were the last to leave because they didn't want to leave their first mother. They didn't want to leave make it fit this question. They didn't want to leave the garden. Yeah, I think a renaissance of the garden of land care would be such medicine. And I think that there is, sometimes I feel a little sad because it feels like there is a bit of a barrier of entry into the garden. And I don't think that was the Creator's intention from the beginning. But I think reacquainting people, and I would even go as far to say like reacquainting children to understanding just where literally everything comes from, like their food and their medicine, and their like allowing children to explore just the great outdoors. Like, I think that is a really good start. And for folks to learn from the original keepers would mean that our first mother would thrive again. So we're here in North America on Turtle Island. The first keepers were able to tend the land in a way for literally hundreds of thousands of years before contact, Western contact, in a way that was honoring. And there was no concept of like ownership. It was just being a steward. And so I think what's so beautiful is in a practice and a posture of reciprocity, there's like the land gives lavishly. And I think for us, that question, we've been asked that question before in another type of way. And so right now I'm just thinking about a conversation that spun out of that question or a similar question about like the memory that the land holds and the triumphs and the traumas that the land holds. And I'm just imagining Ninawaya or like the first mother. I'm imagining her seeing her children in shackles on the land or being forced thousands of miles away from her womb, you know, to another place. I think that until we can agree, or not even agree, but acknowledge and operate from a collective understanding of true history around the trauma and the triumphs on this land, on Turtle Island, I think that there will always be barriers of entry. And I think that people will always be like being, maybe like the divestment away from the land will lead to like sickness and sadness. And I don't know, I just, what I have seen in my adult life is it feels like people are always striving to get back to their first mother or back to the garden. And as sad, I guess, as that might sound, it also feels so hopeful. Like we are always, always walking toward, or our posture is always toward getting back to our first mother, back to the garden. So I think the beginning is acknowledging pain points or traumas, or, and then celebrating the triumphs together. Mm-hmm. I think another really, really big, and I kind of just mentioned it, about leaning on the knowledge of the first keepers. And I just very explicitly put that in a container is like, what I'm saying is upholding land sovereignty and tribal sovereignty, and even spinning out of those things, food sovereignty. It's land back, it's family back, it's garden back, yeah. You know, it's love back, it's reciprocity back, it's kinship back. And I'm hopeful for those things. And I hope that our work at the Wild Mother, my work personally, my work in becoming a good ancestor, I hope that it all points to garden back, you know, going back to the first mother. Yeah, that I'm just like so convinced. But yeah, those are my thoughts. I hope it's not like clear as mud.
No, that's wonderful. So thank you so much for everything that you've shared. It's really incredible.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for listening. Garden People is produced with generous support from our sponsor, Plant Gem. Plant Gem sells unique plants you won't find anywhere else for a garden that reflects your personal style. Find them at www.plantgem.com. As always, thank you for supporting the companies that support this podcast. If you enjoyed the show, we'd love it if you left a review, as it helps other garden people find us. You'll find links for everything we've discussed in the show notes or on our website. To get early access to our guest list and information about bonus episodes, gardening tips from our guests, and more, sign up for the newsletter at violeteerstudio.com.